How y'all doing? My name is Chuck, and I am an addict. I sure appreciate y'all being here tonight. I did what my first sponsor told me to do, is that was to come early. So I got here early. I think there was five people here when I got here. And I also did what my first sponsor told me to do, and that was to help out and get involved, talk to everybody I see. And man, I've talked to a lot of these people. I mean, I got to know y'all. I really appreciate you guys being my friends, man. I really do. And if you don't believe it, we're all miracles, man. We are all miracles here tonight. I also like to thank some of my home group members that showed tonight for support, for coming up here and supporting me. I really appreciate it. I also like to thank a couple guys that I spend a lot more time with here from the Butler area. When I got here, I didn't know anybody. You know, I didn't know anybody. I just recently moved back to the Pittsburgh area. I was gone. Y'all might be able to hear a little southern accent. I was gone down south for 30 years, man. And we got recovery down south. What a blessing, man. What a blessing, I tell you. I grew up in a poor family. But it was an awful, abusive family. And it hurt. It hurt bad. From the time that I was a child, all I can remember through my teenage years was I wanted to get the hell out of Pittsburgh. I had to go, and I really didn't know why, but I know the mental and the physical and the verbal abuse. Today, I know that that was the reason why I wanted to run. When I was 9, I found my first escape, the way to get away from that, and that was through playing baseball. The more I played baseball, the better I became, the less time that I had to stay in that house. Even to this day, my siblings still call it, and I do also. We still call it the house of demons. And little did I know, almost 2 years after that, my second escape, I smoked my first joint. And I was almost 11 years old. And didn't know how many demons that I was going to have when I smoked that first joint. By the time I was 12 years old, all my affection, all my love, all the compassion, all the hugs I didn't get from my family, I got from people on the outside through playing baseball. My immediate family, besides my parents and my sister, they never was able to do it. None of them was able to show affection. None of them was able to give any of those feelings and any of those emotions. But I got them from other people. When I was 12, I became a star. The ball team I played on was the Pennsylvania State Champions. And man, it was unbelievable. The attention that I got from other people on the outside, I just knew and I felt that I didn't want to go to my own home. I wanted to be with other people. And you know, but I had that secret. I had that secret, man. And I couldn't tell anybody about it. And when I was 15 years old, I shot up my first hit of yellow dioxin, speed. Couldn't tell anybody about it. all the way through 19, I was playing ball, getting high, looking for something from somebody else, some acceptance for who I was. And the more I used, the less that I felt that I needed anybody around me or in my life, man. Because I was getting that attention on the ball field. From 13 years old, from the first time that I got caught, through my parents, through other family members, through teachers, through baseball coaches, everybody knew that I was getting high because I was getting caught all the time. And nobody didn't know what to do with me, man. They didn't know what to do with me. In high school, I was a star. Star athlete, star player, man. Had all the women, you know, the whole nine yards. But I was hiding the drugs, man, trying the best I could to hide and not let anybody know what I was doing. I did every drug that anybody had that I can get, man. I did not understand it. You know, when I was 12, I said I would never shoot drugs in my arm. 3 years later, that's what I was doing. I couldn't understand it. I just could not understand it, man. The only time that my parents tried to help me was when I first got caught from my dad. You know? And you know what they did? They brought the Catholic priest to the house to talk to me. You know? In which, you know, obvious that didn't work. That was obvious. I graduated at high school, 17. I went to small college the first year just to play ball. I didn't even finish. After the season was over of playing ball there, I got asked to play for the Little Pirates. Everything in the cards was right for me to be a professional ball player. I had tryouts with Chicago Cubs, tryouts with the White Sox. And at 19, the coach from the White Sox, I was at training. After the first week that I was there, he came up and told me that someone had said that I was getting high out on the balcony. The dorm was a place where we stayed at, ball players, me and another guy. And I told him, like I've told everyone else every time I got caught, I promised them that I would stop. I made that promise over and over and over again. And it never worked. It just never worked. The second week at training, he told me I have to go back to Pittsburgh where I came from because he wasn't going to use any ball players on his team that's going to be continuing to do drugs. I blew it, man. I blew my opportunity to play ball in the big leagues because of drugs. It hurt. It hurts today. I still play ball today. I'll be 49 years old and I still play ball. When I got in recovery, what's my clean date, in case any of y'all wonder what my clean date is June 5th, 1984. When I got into recovery, I played baseball every year since I got into recovery because I loved that game, man. But it was so hard for me to understand why I blew it. I just didn't understand why I blew it, man. I thought it was just, you know, one of those things, you know. Not everybody makes it. You know. But I understand that I was used to running and I needed to get away. So when I got sent back to Pittsburgh, instead of facing embarrassment, once again, I packed up my things, took my girlfriend with me, and moved to South Carolina to get away and run. I got there in South Carolina. In a matter of 2 weeks, I found all the right people. The party was on, man. I was doing the same shit. I couldn't get away from it, man. Couldn't understand it, man. Here I am. I just blew my opportunity of playing Major League Baseball. And I was getting high after I got down there again in South Carolina. Didn't put two and two together, man. You know? Stupidity, man. Absolutely stupidity. After being there, working several months, I got a job, good job. I got introduced to moonshine. And Lord, it was a good moonshine too, man. A guy I worked with parents had a still in their house, man, you know. I was like, what the hell? I can remember the first time I had that, man. It was like, God, unbelievable, you know. Hell. And then it led into the other drugs that I was doing, you know, everything that it was down there. But I, for some reason, they had a hell of a lot of Quaaludes down south, man. I couldn't figure out why. It must have been the drop-off point, man, for the Quaaludes just to be dropped off there and everybody kept them instead of sending them up north, man, you know. Hell, I was doing speed up here, you know, and everything else, but no Quaaludes. So I tried to mix all that stuff, you know. I was doing good, mixing everything I could, man. Terrorizing, tormenting, causing trouble, man. You know, girlfriend scared as hell, you know. I got to become like my parents, man, verbally and physically and mentally abusive, you know. And I had that girl scared shitless. Scared shitless. I met another guy on the job. His dad had a farm, you know, southern farmers, right? I can put that together, right? But he said, out of his daddy's farm, he grows a little bit of pot every once in a while, you know. And if I wanted to grow some pot, man, I'd be more than welcome to do so. I was like, oh, hell. Well, that's cool, you know. So he said, but all you got to do is just get it started, you know, in your house, convert your spare bedroom into, you know, growing room. And so I said, oh, yeah, that's cool. I can do that. So, you know, I got all this literature and shit on how to do it, man. You know, I was going to work hard, man, right? So I asked him, I said, you know, how many should I plant, man? You know, how many should I grow? And he said, oh, it doesn't matter, man. My dad's got a big farm. I said, okay, no problem. So, you know, after they got about, you know, 18 inches, 2 feet high, it was time to take them out and transplant them, man, right? He comes into my office and I show him my, you know, my personal growing room. And he opened the door and said, holy shit, what the hell are you going to do with it? I had 150 plants growing and he had 12 in the back of the pickup truck to go out to the farm. Hell, we got to make more than one trip. That's all I know, man. We got to get these things out here because she's ready to leave my ass, man. She's so paranoid, we're going to get busted, and she's going to jail, too. You know? So that's what we did. That's what we did, man. And it got worse and worse. I mean, I got into so much trouble, you know, that I had to run again. I mean, you know, getting locked up several times and getting out, and she would be there, and then she didn't want to be there, and she just couldn't take it, man. And I thought, well, there's nothing wrong, man. You know, this is cool, you know. But, you know, this is who I was at the time, man. This is who I was at the time. So I got a job offer in Atlanta, Georgia. A buddy of mine from Pittsburgh got this promotion in his job, and he was hiring people in Atlanta, Georgia. So he gives me a call and says, "Hey, you want a job, man? I can get you all this money, man. You know, how much you making now?" I said, "Oh, hell, I can get you three times as much as that, you know." And so I told my girlfriend, which was now my fiance, because I really didn't want her to leave. So I thought by getting engaged to her, man, that she's going to stick around and stay a little bit longer. You know, so we drive down to Georgia. And on the way back, after I do the job thing, and we looked around, man, you know, she says, "I'm not going down there. I don't want to live down there." I said, "Why? It's a great opportunity. You know, I had it all planned out before I even left South Carolina to go to Atlanta, you know." And the job was for the Atlanta International Airport, man. I was going to be able to work inside this airport that was being built, man. And so I fussed for about a week with her, you know, and then my buddy called from down there and says, "Well, you're going to take the job?" And I said, "Hell yeah, I'm going to take the job, man," because I was getting out with him long ago, man, you know, so I didn't even care about what the hell she was doing. And that's what happened to me every time that I had some connection, some feelings for somebody else. The drugs made me not care for whoever the hell it was, man, you know. And all I did was run, you know. And I ran. I ran down there, packed my shit, left her there, went by myself, and never seen or spoken or heard from her again. You know, and that's one of my amends that I've always wanted to make, but I, you know, I guess I can do the Google thing now and maybe try to find her, you know, but you know, I wouldn't know what she looked like anyways, but that's all right, man. I wouldn't even remember. But anyway, so I get down there. I get this nice little apartment. You know, I lived upstairs, and there was this fine Southern belle living downstairs, man. I was like, all right. And I met her 3 days later. And I'm saying, "Hey, do you get high?" And she said, "Oh, yeah, yeah, I get high all the time." I said, "Great, man." You know, and she said, "Well, come on in." So I walk into her, you know, little apartment there, and she said, "Hold on a minute, I'll be back." And she comes back with a big Ziploc bag full of Quaaludes. There had to be over 1,000 of them. I said, "Holy shit, man, here I am," man, you know. And for the next 4 months, I guarantee you, I probably spent maybe, walked into my own apartment about 12, a dozen times, man, 12 times. I was living and staying down there. She was a supplier, which I found out real shortly, you know, selling drugs, and a security guard out at the Atlanta airport. Go figure, man. Hey, I was working there too, you know what I mean? It was like, great, man, we can get high and party all the time. Well, it wasn't even open yet, which made it better, you know, because we was able to do whatever we wanted to do. You know, the people that I work with, man, and my buddy that hired me, you know, hell, we was getting smashed every day, having fun, man, partying. And four months later, I come back to the apartment, and she's gone. All her shit's gone. It's like, what the hell happened, you know? And I'm like, damn, man, I got to find somebody else now, you know, because and she introduced me to all these people, but, you know, I was only there 4 months, and, you know, I wasn't really connected, you know. But then I started making those connections, and it led me into being connected with some high class people, you know, because I grew up poor. These people were rich, man. And they liked me. And the only reason why I know today is why they liked me. They got high and party was I worked at the airport. And I was able to get drugs, big drugs, in and out of there with no problem at all. So I start transporting drugs in and out of the airport. As soon as it opened up, the whole game plan was set out, and that was going to be my job. But I really had another job working there. But I made more money bringing these things in and out of the airport than I did at my other my job that put me at the airport, you know. And I didn't care. I didn't think about getting caught, you know, because nobody was going to be able to catch me. I had access to drive on the tarmac where the planes were at, come in and out of through the security they had, never getting checked, and I had the company van, you know. So I'm talking kilos and kilos of coming in and out of that airport, man, you know, and making thousands and thousands of dollars, because I wasn't going to be poor, and I damn sure I wasn't going to be eating no hot dogs and hamburgers for the rest of my life like I did. You know, I met some of you guys. I got to say this. When we went to you guys had the picnic about 6 weeks ago, and that was my first time, you know, first picnic coming up here meeting you guys. And they had hot dogs and hamburgers, man. I said, damn, is that all you people eat, man, is hot dogs and hamburgers? Because, you know, I just, you know, moved here from the South, man. I wasn't expecting, you know, just to have hot dogs and hamburgers. But anyway, that was it got me, man. I could not believe here I am again eating hot dogs and hamburgers, and you know, I'm not poor, you know. I wasn't poor today, man, and I wasn't poor when I used. I wasn't poor when I got into recovery, man. You know, the more money I had was great because the more drugs I was able to do, man. But I end up, that was in 1980 when I moved to Atlanta. And about 2 years later, I was rolling, man. I mean, I had professional ball players, baseball, basketball. I had professional singers, ones that I know that you probably bought albums from. You know, and records and CDs or whatever now, you know. I was in $2-3 million mansions, man, rolling up, carrying packages in, and I couldn't believe it. I was just like poor. I mean, I felt like this, you know, I was this poor little kid, man, and this was my time. This was my time to go head on and live life the way I wanted to live it, and that was just getting high constantly and constantly. Every day, man. And until finally, that damn Richard Pryor screwed everything up. You know, son of a bitch. I got introduced into freebasing, man, and I was like on my way out so damn fast, man. First, I became the best cook around, and all the people, all these big wigs that I was hanging with wanted me to come over and bite this so I can cook, you know, bring that shit back to rocks, man. And, well, yeah, hell, as long as I can get some, you know. And I smoked, and I shot up, and I smoked, and I shot up, man. I drank and drank and smoked and shot up, man. And I thought I was doing so good, so well, and then it hit me, man. It just absolutely hit me like a brick in the head, in the side of the head, man. I found myself, I got a condo all through that money-making stuff, man, you know. So I found myself in my condo one night, sitting there by myself on a Friday night, which is, you know, we don't do that, you know. And I had an 8-ball of coke, a Christian Guidepost magazine, with my pipe sitting on the table, a loaded military 45 semi-automatic handgun in my right hand with the barrel pointed at my temple, ready to blow my damn brains out. That is the first time that I thought something was wrong with me. It didn't matter that I was 119 pounds from 195. It took like 9 months of smoking that shit, man, to pull me down that fast, man. I couldn't believe it. It was the first time that I actually thought, well, maybe I do have a problem. And I was so scared because I couldn't put that damn gun down. I didn't know who to call. I didn't have anybody to yell and reach out to, man, and say, I'm in trouble, you know. I didn't have anybody because everybody was using everybody. All my friends were using friends for my whole life. And like any good addict, I was staring at that damn cocaine and I put the gun down, man. And I spent the next 2 days smoking coke, drinking, just getting blasted. And then I had to go to work after that. I could barely walk. I didn't want to go into work, but the head manager had called because I had already tried to call off. You know how we always try to call off work? Well, he called, said, hey, you got to come into work today. I said, well, I can't, man. I got something else I got to do. It's real important. And I couldn't get up. He said, no, you got to be there or you don't have a job. I thought, well, this is not going to work out, man. I need a job. Hell, I was making, not for the money, because I was making money off them drugs I was pushing through the airport, man. You know, so I got up, went to work, and I worked in the control room by myself. And about 3 hours after being there, I picked up the yellow pages and looked under drugs. And it said, C Pharmacy. So I flipped to freaking pharmacy, man, you know. It was Eckerd's, you know, Drug Emporium, CVS. And I was like, shit. And that's all there was, you know. That was all there was. Like, well, shit, well, now what am I going to do? Because at that moment, I could have put that book away and continued on and tried to do some more. But instead, I turned to alcohol. And in that, it had Alcoholics Anonymous Hotline. So I called that number. And the lady on the other end of the phone, man, I was telling her what was going on with me, and she says, hold on a minute, I'm gonna be right back with you here. I got a phone number for you. So she gives me a phone number. She says, promise me that you'll call this phone number. I said, I will. I'll promise, you know. So I did. As soon as I hung up, I called. It was to a Ridgeview Institute Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center. I didn't know anything about it. You know, I just knew that for 20 minutes, God bless that lady, she had me boo-hooing, crying, telling me everything was going to be all right. But she was also scared and worried that I was going to kill myself. Because she was the person, the only person that I was able to open up to, honestly, for the first time about how I felt, what was happening with me by using drugs, man. She wanted to send somebody out to the airport to come and get me to make sure I didn't kill myself. She thought I was at home. She didn't know, you know, I was at work. By the time I got talking to her, you know, she thought I was going to kill myself. I said, no, I'll be all right. She says, sir, I promise you I can get you a bed in 2 days. I said, great. I'll be there in 2 days. So naturally, you know what happened for the next 2 days, man. You know? Did the coke. Did everything I could in 2 days. Didn't sleep. Did everything that I wanted to do as far as drinking. Had a buddy of mine, told him what happened. He says, well, what are you going to do about work? How are you going to tell them? What are you going to say to them? I said, I don't know, man, but I'm going to go over there in the morning and let them know, man, that I'm not going to be coming back to work in 2 days, man, because I put myself into a drug and alcohol treatment center. And when I went and told them, they said, what? There's nothing wrong with you. Hell, I know you go out, and we all go out, and we party. I said, no, there's more to it than that, man, you know. And I said, here's the number if you want to call them. I'm going to be gone in 2 days. So I had that same buddy of mine drive me over to the treatment center. And, of course, naturally, you know, I had my last two hits of rock in the car, you know, smoking dope. Oh, I love drinking Strohs, man, you know. So I had a quart of Strohs. And opened the door, and there was this long sidewalk that went up into the front doors of the treatment center. I opened the door, man. I swear I tripped on the curb, but I fell out and busted my ass, and all this smoke come out of the damn car, man, you know. And here comes a guy and a lady, and the lady's pushing a wheelchair, man, you know. And the guy was yelling at my buddy to get the hell out of here because, you know, where the smoke is coming, still coming out of the car, man, you know. So the lady grabbed my bag. The guy put me in the wheelchair, picked me up off the ground, man, rolled me into those doors, man, and I promise you, man, my life has changed completely since I got into those doors, man. It wasn't easy. I fought it for the first week or so. Of course, I was in detox for about 4 days, and when I got out, I wouldn't listen to anyone. I didn't want to do nothing. All I wanted to do was get the hell out of there. I knew I messed up, man. You know, I knew I messed up. And besides, the place that I was at, which I found out later, was at that time, was the number one, and I think it still is, number one rated recovery center for doctors and nurses, Caduceus. And they took me because of that lady who answered that phone. Because I wasn't a doctor and I wasn't a nurse, but she knew I needed to help, man. So for 2 weeks, they'd walk by in my room. Hey, ready to come out? And I said, yeah, whenever lunch or dinner or whatever, I would try to eat something, man, you know. But for 2 weeks, every day, counselors, therapists, other addicts recovering in there came to me and asked me if I wanted to live or die. You know, and they, oh, it pissed me off so bad. I could not stand them coming to me and saying, hey, do you want to live or die? You want to live or die today? You want to live or die today? I was like, God, is that all this is going to be about? Is this living or dying? You know, hell, I'm living now, but, I'll be all right. Leave me alone. Well, that was right at my third week of being there, and this is so crazy. They had this little chapel room, and I went into this little chapel room right after eating lunch, I believe, and I got down on my knees, man, for the first time, and I don't know how long, man, you know, because I was raised Catholic, sort of. I knew about praying and getting down on my knees, but I prayed and I cried out to God, man, with tears in my eyes and saying, God, I'm ready, please help me. I don't know what to do, but I don't want to die. And as soon as I said, I don't want to die, the door opened, and there's this therapist, this lady. Are you coming to group or not? You know, and so I got up and turned around. She took me by the hand, gave me a hug, and took me to my first group meeting, man, in rehab. From that point on, I did what they told me to do. Believe it or not, man, I did what they told me to do. I surrendered right then and there. As soon as I hit my knees for the first time, I know I surrendered right then and there because I was willing to do what somebody else would tell me to do. And believe me, I didn't tell any of the horror stories, you know, of what I had done and what I had gone through, man. But when they told me to write, I wrote. When they told me to read, you know, a step, I read, man. When they told me I needed to write about my life, I wrote. I had 32 pages about my life that I wrote. everything that I can think of and remember. 32 pages. And it was God awful, man. It was so hard. I was mentally and emotionally broke. No spirituality whatsoever, except for the time I got on my knees and asked God to help me. Whenever they told me to do something, I did it. Let me go back a second. My third week there, I went to my first NA meeting, man. And, of course, it was on site. But there were other people from the outside that was able to come to these meetings. In fact, those were the people who were going to talk at the meetings. And I remember going, and all these people were in there. You're going to love this, man. You're just going to love this. A lady comes out, and she's the guest speaker. I'm sitting there, and she's talking all this shit. Man, I still didn't want to hear it, but I knew I was writing everything I could about it anyways. You know, not her shit, but mine, you know, back in the center. And in 10 minutes after she's still talking what's going on with her, she stops. Points out into the crowd and said, "Hey, I know you, Chuck." I said, "Damn." I was slouching down in that chair trying to hide so bad because I knew who it was. It was my Quaalude queen that I lost back in 1980, man. Here she was standing up here in recovery telling her story. I was like, "Holy shit, I can't believe it." She said, because I called her Quaalude Queen, man, you know what I mean? So she's like, "Okay, I'll talk to you after I'm done, man, you know. So be quiet," you know, in other words. I felt so embarrassed because I know all the shit I did with her in 4 months, and she was going to talk about me and her doing this crazy-ass stuff, man, you know, shooting drugs, doing these clothes, and, you know, having all this. I just thought she was going to reveal all that, man, you know. So I was, you know, I was really embarrassed. But I was the highlight after the meeting was over because everybody that was in there were doctors and shit, man. And here's this crazy-ass lady telling her story, man. She wasn't no doctor or nothing, but, hey, I wasn't either. So, they all, "Hey, man, you know." I said, "Yeah, you don't want to know." You know, so I said, "Yeah, you don't want to know." You know, but, and I felt real, I felt left out a lot because I wasn't a doctor. And, oh, Lordy, you know, when you go to the doctor and they talk these words that are about that long, man, it's like, holy shit, they're doing the same thing while I'm sitting right next to them talking, you know, trash talk, man, about what, you know, what they do. And anesthesiologists, man, surgeons, you know, all the nurses. And all they knew to talk about was this hospital talk, you know, just hospital talk. Well, I finally said something to him one day. I said, "Hey, man, look, I'm from the streets." I didn't do that. So they started including me in. Well, I spent 3 months inpatient. And before I was ready to get out, one of them damn counselors, he wanted to really help me out a lot, said, "Hey, I got a suggestion for you. You know, we got to let you out here because, like, you're way over the scale of the money that my company wanted to put out for me to be in there. But we still think you need a little bit more time." I said, "Okay, what's up? You know, what's going on here, man?" Well, he said, "We want to put you in a halfway house." I said, "What the hell is a halfway house, man?" You know, I didn't know what a halfway house was. You know, it's where you go and live with, you know, different guys, and, you know, you're all trying to stay clean and everything like that. And I said, "Well, so far I've done everything you told me to do. I'll do it." So I did. Anyway, I went, and I spent 3 months in that halfway house. But, you know, something just wasn't right. Because they didn't want me to get involved in a relationship. Well, you know, I met this nurse, you know, that was in the rehab center, and I was getting involved with. You know, and then when she got out, she started sneaking, you know, because they bust our asses to meetings and stuff, man, and she started sneaking and going to those meetings, and, you know, so I didn't leave that alone, you know. And eventually I got caught, or we got caught, because I had this little free pass that they said I can have to go, and I went. Anyway, 6 months, I'm in a safe and secure environment around recovering addicts, man. You know, morning, noon, and night, 24/7, man. I got my first 90 days, you know, really by being in a halfway house and going to meeting every damn day, man, besides all the meetings we had, you know, inside the house. And then it was time for me to go. It was time for me to get out. It was time for me to go back to work. But I didn't know where I was going to live. You know, I had money, but I didn't know where to go. And the only people that I knew was this people who were getting high. So I got one of the guys to help me out, find me a roommate, a recovering addict. I'm working the steps, man. He's working the steps. And maybe within 2 months, man, he opened the door on a Sunday, man, and looked so shit-faced. I knew what happened. He was getting high. I was like, damn, you got to get out of here because I'm not leaving. You got to go. There's no way in hell I can do this because I know I can't get high. You know, so he left. Right before I left that halfway house, I sort of got signed up for some outpatient, you know, outpatient therapy, individual and group, because I was really nuts and I needed it, man. And really, which I didn't know then, the drugs really wasn't my problem, man. It was me, you know. So I went. And I was going to meetings. How we say we go to meetings 2-3 times a day, you know, because we need to. Well, I had to do that kind of stuff, man. But I went to this therapy for 2 years. 2 years, man. 2 years. So I kept myself surrounded by everybody in recovery, man. It didn't matter to me if you, at that time, man, how long you had, who you were. I just knew you were trying to stay clean like I was, man, you know. And I end up really getting on this spiritual kick for some reason and trying to open up more to other ideas. And I became one of them gurus. Well, my sponsor told me, hey, man, you know, you just gotta slow down. I know you did all this kind of stuff, man, but, you know, you just gotta slow down and listen at the meetings and do what was told of you. Keep writing on your steps. It took me 2.5 years to go through my first 12 steps, man. You know, I did 3 steps at a time. And 2.5 years later, I finally got to my, you know, 10, 11, and 12. That's how it worked for me. I just had to do it in my own time. And when people talk today, it's your own time, you know. And for me, that's real important, is to allow us to have our freedom, man, to work our own program, not be judgmental or critical. You know, and the best thing is what I've always heard, which we all heard, was to go to meetings, you know, work the steps. I work the steps today and incorporate everything into my life, man, just by working the steps. And it has changed so many times since I've been clean. Over and over and over again, and it just kept getting greater and greater, the rewards that I've gotten, man. You know, call my sponsor. Someone mentioned to me the other day about having a sponsor up here, and I said no, you know, because I didn't get one, but I still, you know, keep in touch with the one I have down in Georgia. And, of course, he's been telling me to do the same thing, because the people I had sponsored, I had to tell all them to get one, you know. But sometimes we just don't take our own advice, man. Sometimes we just don't do that, man. But I believe for myself, one of the most important things now is just to make friends in recovery, man. You know, because you people, man, I'm telling you, have helped me all through the years of staying clean. And I reach out as much as I can. Sometimes it's hard, you know, to get through the fear, you know, of talking and saying hello to people. But I just do it, man. You know, I just remember what my first sponsor said. And my first sponsor I had 18 years. He relapsed at 23 years, the same amount of time as I have now. So when I got here, the next day after I arrived, I went to a meeting, man, you know, because that still weighs on me to this day that I could not believe that my sponsor that had 23 years went back out and used, man. I mean, that was a wake-up call to me, you know. He was my sponsor, like, for 5 years, you know, almost 5 years. And he went back out. And he went back out because of the relationship, you know. And there's so many things that we hear in here as far as not being involved or getting involved in relationships. And if we do, that's fine. But it's so difficult to manage our own recovery program. And, you know, and if your relationship and if they're in recovery, it's so difficult to get through. Well, anyway, I end up finding me another Southern Belle. She was in recovery. I got married. And we had a son. She had, at that time, I think 7 or 8 years clean. And she used. And I was devastated, man. I didn't know what to do, you know. I was just completely devastated. So I end up... I end up getting a divorce. I had to. She wouldn't stop using. And I didn't want to start. You know, and sometimes I know we may have to make some hard-ass decisions in here, you know. And I know we talk about, you know, weathering the storms, man, getting through the situations. I put myself right in the middle of all you people boo-hooing and crying, man, because I had to get divorced. But the blessing out of it all was a month later, I received my son. I became a single parent, raising my son in recovery. I've took my son into recovery since he was 6 months old. And he needs this program today. I had to learn that I had to let him go, or otherwise I was going to go right with him, you know. I also had to let him know, well, I was told that I wasn't his higher power. He has his own, and whatever God's will is for him is going to be done no matter what I do. Because for the past 3 years, I tried to do everything to get that boy in here. He wasn't coming. Hell, he could probably read that book better than I could today. Because he was in recovery all those years growing up. He's been using for 6 years now. He's 19 years old. Running that same damn path that I ran, you know. And I have no control over it. It's so hard to accept that, man. It's so hard to accept that, man. But by going back and working the steps for me, man, praying and doing the things that I need to do, talking to people and getting a sponsor, man, recovery to me today, I love this program. It has given me a life to be able to get out there, do all kinds of things with all kinds of people from all over the place, and feel part of and connected. And I have the joy, the happiness, man. I have love with you people. I've gone all over and traveled in world conventions, and no matter where I go, I'm always welcomed, man. And that has been so overwhelming for all these years. You know, I never thought I was going to be here 23 years later, there was no way in hell I thought I was going to still be here talking to anybody 23 years later, man, and be clean, you know. I just never thought that was going to be possible, man, you know. But I'm here, and through the grace of God, I am here, and I continue to stay here. But all those things that happen, the storms in our lives, man, I sort of lay back a little bit, you know, and don't stress out over them and don't worry. I do what I was told to do, grab somebody in recovery, talk to them, man, you know, because I know I'm going to get through it, you know. I know I'm going to get through it because I finally realized that nothing or no one can ever make me use again except myself, man. We are our worst enemies, man. The other thing for me is I don't hide anything. I don't hide anything from anybody, man, because I learned long ago in our secrets lie our disease. And if I hide and start lying and bullshitting to you people, you know, I'm going down the wrong path. I don't want to do that. I just want to be open to you and let you know who I am, you know, and so I can get to know you, because that's what recovery in NA to me is all about, man. Helping each other to stay clean, man. One day at a time, man. You know, having fun, going to these functions, participating and enjoying our lives, man, because, you know, when we leave these functions, we still got to go out in the world. But here, man, it gives you such an uplift. For me, it gives me such an uplift. And when I go to my home group here, you know, and I've only been here a year, man, and I know a ton of people already because I know I got to exert myself and put myself out there, man, you know. I mean, I could have stood up here and talked about working the steps and doing all that stuff, but, man, I know everybody hears it. Everybody hears it all the time. But, it's, you know, it's up to us, the individual, to work it. You know, you got to work it. I mean, we can preach, you know, but we also have to do the work, man. It doesn't work if you don't work it, man. And that's so simple. All those simple things that we hear, that's what makes this program work, man. I mean, honestly, I'm telling you, that's what makes this work, man. Extending our hand to another recovering addict, man, trying to help them get through the situations they need to get through, man. I'm glad my running has stopped, man. You know, I stopped my, and I don't ever want to run again, man. And I don't ever want to hide or lie, man. Steak, you know, cheat, steal, and do all those other things. I know today that when the wrong is a wrong, when the right is a right. That's what Narcotics Anonymous taught me by working those steps, changing who I was, becoming the person who I want to be. The blessing is, man, check this out. You can be anybody you want to be in here, man. You can mold yourself to whoever you want to be and do it without the use of drugs or alcohol. It doesn't matter. You can do whatever you write down on a piece of paper and that's who you want to be, you can achieve that through this program, man. You know? At one time, you know, I was full of anger and hatred. I would have shot your ass in a minute. And I've done it many times. Today, all I want is a hug. That's all I want. I want to feel that I'm wanted. That I am wanted today, man. That I am loved. That is so important to me, man. And I know in the beginning it was so hard to step forward and to reach out there and say, here, this is who I am, man. But like I said, this program will change your life completely. You can be who you want to be. You can have as many as friends as you want to have. And all you got to do is keep coming here. Keep going to your meetings. Doing the right thing. Just don't pick up the first one. I mean, it's pretty simple. I try not to, you know, get into talking into details, and I try not to preach to people, man, about how to run your program, because, you know, mine is no different than yours, you know, but you're your own person and I'm my own person, you know. And I don't get up and yell and scream. I used to do that, and they say, you know, but that's okay, because this is who I am today, man. Well, before I close, man, I just want to say, I had to leave. A couple hundred recovering addict friends of mine. But when I left, I knew I can make new ones. You know? And it was hard to leave my recovering friends. That was 22 years down there of recovery that I left my people. And this is the first opportunity that I had to speak to and share my experiences and strength and hope with y'all. I need you people. I make it a point to go and do what I have to do and reach out and touch and help and do whatever it takes so I can fill that void that I have inside of me that I left those people down there, and I want to replace it with you people because I'm living here now. This is going to be my new home. I got some things I got to take care of here. I got some storms I got to go through. I'm probably going to lose my dad in a little while. And I just want to be strong. I know I'm going to struggle if I don't have Narcotics Anonymous and you people in my life. I've heard many people talking about getting through death and all in your family. But the hard part is to watch it happen in front of you before the person dies. So that was the reason I came up here. Because I was able to forgive my father by doing the things that I needed to do in this program. He has nobody else. Brother and sister don't speak to him. No one to help him and take care of him, man. I can hug my dad. I can tell him that I love him today. And the greatest thing is, he's able to do it back to me. Because of what Narcotics Anonymous has done for me. He believes in me. You know, he believes in me today. Just like I believe in all you today. I plan on being around and staying around. You're not going to get rid of me because I need you. And I'm going to stay clean and I want to help everyone. And I need the help from y'all too. And I'm not afraid to ask that today, man. I am not embarrassed to ask for the help today. I wrote this little thing down here that I want to say in this, in closing, man. It's just going to lighten it up, man, a little bit, but it's from one of my favorite movies. you know, and you'll get it. And you'll probably figure, boy, is this guy crazy as hell. Because I'm not a movie watcher, man, you know. But the first part, being that I'm from the South, you know, life may be like a box of chocolates. Huh? But living life of recovery through Narcotics Anonymous makes it so much easier. Thank you. My name's Chuck and I am an addict.